courage to face him again. No, she could not go back there without the money. Could she run away for good, from everyone? But where would she go, and how, without money? She didn't even have the money for a taxi back to Penzance, let alone the cash needed for a fresh start in a strange city. Well, whatever she decided, she couldn't hide up here forever. She would have to go down and face the family at some point. Flexing her cold fingers, Hal opened the door. Standing there, perfectly still in the darkness of the corridor, was a figure. Dark clothes disintegrating into the shadows, standing motionless just inches from Hal's face. Hal gasped and took a step backwards into the room, her hand pressed to her chest. Jesus, what? She found her hands were shaking and caught at the metal bedstead to steady herself. As her fright subsided, Hal felt anger flood in its wake. Mrs. Warren? What the hell are you doing snooping outside my room?
"'Tain't your room,"
Mrs. Warren said bitterly. She took a step forward over the threshold, sweeping Hal's meagre possessions with a contemptuous look.
"'And it never will be, if I've anything to do with it."
"'What do you mean?"
"You know."
Hal pushed her hands inside her pockets to hide their trembling. She would not show this old woman she was afraid. Get out of my way!
Just as you like. I came up to tell you. He wants you downstairs.
Who's he? Hal said. She tried to keep her voice steady, and it came out colder and sharper than she meant.
Hardin. He's in the drawing room.
Hal could not bring herself to say thank you, but she nodded once, and Mrs. Warren turned to retreat into the shadows of the corridor. Hal followed her and was just shutting the door of her room behind her when Mrs. Warren spoke, jerking her head back over her shoulder towards the room and the scattering of Hal's belongings.
She was into all that muck.
What? Hal stopped with her hand on the knob, the door just ajar, a crack of room showing through the gap.
Them cards. Tarry or whatever she called it. Pagan stuff it was, devils and naked men. If it was up to me, I wouldn't have had them in the house. I would have burned them all. Disgusting things.
Who? Hal said. But Mrs. Warren only continued slowly down the corridor, as if she hadn't heard, and Hal found herself bounding after her retreating back, grabbing the old woman's wrist harder than she meant, forcing her to turn back to face her. Who? Who are you talking about?
Maggie.
Mrs. Warren spat the name like a swear word, her vehemence sending little flecks of spittle into Hal's face.
And if you know what's good for you, you'll ask me no more questions. Now let go of me.
What? Hal gasped. The words hit like a slap in the face, and the questions rose up inside her, churning too quickly to be caught. But the one that beat inside Hal's skull was unsayable. Did she know? Before Hal could do more than gasp, Mrs. Warren had wrenched her wrist out of Hal's grip with a strength Hal would not have given her credit for, and hurried away down the stairs, silent and malevolent. Hal let out a long, shuddering breath, and then went back inside the bedroom, her heart beating fast enough to make her feel dizzy with it. Maggie. Her mother's nickname, Maggie. Her mother who had been here more than 20 years ago. What had Mrs. Warren meant in bringing her up now? Was it a threat? Did she know the truth? But if so, why had she stood by and said nothing? There were no answers. And at last, for want of anything else, Hal picked up the tarot cards and began to pack them back into the tin. Mrs. Warren's threat echoed in her head. She wouldn't really dare to burn them, would she? It seemed ridiculous. And yet there was something about the venom in her voice that made Hal think it might be a real possibility. There was no lock on the bedroom door, or on the case, so all Hal could do was pack the cards away inside their tin, push them deep into her suitcase, and hope for the best. What had made her pack them in the first place? It wasn't as though she believed. Hal zipped up the case and turned to leave the room, but then, with a sudden misgiving, she stopped, opened the case, and pushed the tin into her back pocket, alongside the photograph. Let Mrs. Warren snoop. Let her come and look through every pocket of the case. It was only as she reached the top of the narrow windowless stairs to the second floor that a thought came to her. A memory of yesterday. Of the tap, tap of Mrs. Warren's cane on the wooden steps of the secret staircase. But the woman standing outside her doorway just now had held no cane, and her approach had been utterly silent. The thought made Hal shiver for no reason that she could put her finger on, and she wished again that there was a lock on the bedroom door. She had never felt the need for one before coming here, but the thought of that bitter old woman creeping silently about the house at night, opening the door to Hal's room. Hal paused, looking along the narrow, dark corridor, remembering the way Mrs. Warren had stood there in the darkness. What was she doing? Listening? Watching? She was about to carry on downstairs when something caught her eye, a darkness in the dark, and she made her way back to stand in front of the closed door, running her fingers over the wood, feeling, rather than seeing, how very wrong she had been. There was a lock on the door. Two, in fact. They were long, thick bolts, top and bottom, but they were on the outside. Chapter 20. There was no sign of Mrs. Warren when Hal finally descended to the hallway below, and for a moment she stood there, trying to get her bearings and remember which of the wooden doors hid the drawing room. She had passed it on her way to breakfast, but then the door had stood open. Now they were all closed, and the long, monotonous hallway with its featureless tiled floor and identical wooden doors was surprisingly disorientating. Hal tried one at random, but it opened onto a dim, panelled dining room, far grander than the breakfast room they had used that morning. The tall windows were shuttered, thin grey shafts of light piercing the shadows, and a vast table draped with calico dust sheets stretched the length of the room. Above her head hung two huge shapes swathed in grey that at first, in the darkness, Hal thought were giant wasps' nests. She ducked reflexively before her eyes adjusted, and she realised they must be chandeliers, encased in some sort of protective covering. Her footsteps swirled in the dust, and backing out slowly, she closed the door quietly behind her and made her way up the hall. At the next doorway, she put her hand out to knock, but before her knuckles could make contact with the wood, she heard a voice coming from inside and paused for a moment, unsure if she was about to interrupt a private conversation.
"Conniving little gold digger!"
It was a man's voice, one of the brothers, Hal thought, but she could not be sure of which.
"Oh, really, you are impossible!"
A woman's voice, Mitzi's, clipped with impatience.
"She's an orphan! No doubt your mother felt sorry for her."
"First of all, we have no proof of that whatsoever. We know nothing about this girl. We have no idea who her father is or was, or whether he's still in the picture. For all we know, he could have put Mother up to this. And second...
It was Harding, Hal realized as he raised his voice to speak over Mitzi's exasperated protests.
Second, Mitzi, if you had known my mother in the least, you would realize how very unlikely it would be for her to be motivated by anything as charitable as pity for an orphan.
Oh, Harding, what nonsense! Your mother was a lonely old woman, and perhaps if you'd been willing to let bygones be bygones, the children and I might have got to know her a little better, and this whole situation...
My mother was a bitter, cruel harpy,
Harding shouted.
And any reluctance to let you and the children be exposed to her venom was entirely out of concern for you, so don't you dare suggest that this situation is my fault, Mitzi.
I wasn't suggesting that for a moment, Mitzi said, and a placatory note had crept into her voice beneath the irritation.
I understand your motives were good, darling, but I just think that perhaps it's not really surprising at this point if your mother chose to pass over two sons who were completely estranged and a third who kept his wife and children away for nearly 20 years. I can't blame your mother for being a little hurt. I certainly would be. When was the last time we were down here? Richard can't have been more than 7.
7, yes, and she told him he was a snivelling little coward when he burned his finger on the grate, remember?
I'm not saying she didn't have her faults.
Mitzi, you are not listening to me. My mother was a bitter, poisonous woman, and her one aim in life was to spread that poison as far and wide as she could. It's exactly like her to continue to spread division from beyond the grave. The sole surprise is that she didn't leave the entire place to Ezra in the hope that he, Abel, and I would end up in bitter dispute over all this, and the whole estate would get swallowed up in legal fees.
Oh, Harding, that's absurd.
I should have seen it coming,
Harding said. And Hal had the feeling he was no longer even really listening to his wife.
She wrote to me, do you know that, about a month ago. No word of her illness, of course, that would have been too simple, too straightforward. Oh, no. She wrote her usual letter full of complaints, but her sign-off was different. That's what should have told me.
Different how?
She signed off always, your mother. Always. Even when I was at boarding school, crying my eyes out every night. All the other boys' mothers signed off with love and kisses and ever your adoring mummy and 1,000 hugs, all that sort of tripe. But mother, no. Your mother. That was it. No love, no kisses, just a cold statement of fact. A perfect metaphor, in fact, for her life.
And the last time, did she add something?
Yes,
Harding said, and he paused, a brooding silence that made Hal hold her breath, wondering what was coming. Not the love that Harding had waited all his life for, surely. The silence stretched until Hal thought she must have missed whatever Harding was about to say, or that he had thought better of it, and she raised her hand, ready to knock on the door and announce her presence. But finally Harding spoke.
She finished. Après moi, le déluge. That was all. No name, no sign-off, just those 4 words.
Après what?
Mitzi sounded completely nonplussed.
After the rain? What on earth does it mean?
But before Hal could hear Harding's answer, she heard a voice at her back.
Eavesdropping.
Hal spun round, her heart thumping. It was Harding's daughter. What was her name?
Kitty.
She was standing in the corridor, twirling her long blonde hair around one finger and chewing something. When Hal didn't speak, she held out a packet in one hand.
Tangfastic?
I... Hal swallowed. She spoke low, not wanting Harding and Mitzi to hear from inside the room. I was about to go into the room, but they seemed...
Hey, no shade from me.
The girl threw up her free hand, the charm bracelet on her wrist jangling.
It's the only way I ever find out anything around here.
She pulled out a jelly shape from the packet, examined it critically, and then popped it in her mouth.
Look, I keep meaning to ask. What are you?
I what? Hal swallowed again. Her mouth felt dry, and she flexed her cold fingers inside her pockets, digging her nails into her palm, trying to anchor herself. She was uncomfortably aware that the Pandora bracelet Kitty was wearing on her left wrist probably cost more than her own entire outfit, possibly more than her whole wardrobe. What am I? I'm not sure what you...
I mean, like, I know you're some kind of relation, but Dad hasn't really explained the connection. Are you the missing aunt? No, wait. You're too young, right?
Oh! Right. No. She blinked, trying to remember what exactly she was supposed to be doing here. The photograph of her mother lounging on the lawn outside the drawing room flashed through her mind, and she screwed her eyes shut for a moment against the image, rubbing her forehead as if to vanquish her mother's face. She must not think about her mother. She had to remember who she was supposed to be, not who she was. Maud was Harding's sister, which meant... I guess I'm your cousin?
Oh, right. So your mum was the one who ran away?
I suppose so, yes. She didn't really talk about it.
So cool,
the girl said enviously. She pushed another Haribo in her mouth and spoke around it.
Not gonna lie, there's been points where I've seriously considered it. But I reckon you need to be at least 18 to pull it off, otherwise you're pretty much guaranteed to end up on the streets, and there's no way I'm turning tricks for some pedo pimp.
Hal found herself completely at a loss. This girl was self-assured in a way that Hal had never been.
How old are you? 14. Rich is nearly 16. Freddie's 12. He's a total dickwad, so I wouldn't bother with him. Rich is okay if you can get him to take his headphones off. And hey, I'm at a girls' school. I need to keep on his good side, right? He's my shortcut to hot older boys.
I never really thought about it like that, Hal said faintly.
Have you got a boyfriend?
Kitty asked. Hal shook her head.
Girlfriend?
No, I've not really been in the right place for dating for the last couple of years.
Gotcha,
Kitty said wisely. She nodded and put another Haribo in her mouth.
You should try a dating app. They can match you up by location.
That wasn't really what I... Hal began. But just then, the drawing room door opened and both their heads turned to see Mitzi standing there.
Oh, girls, I thought I heard voices. Kitty, if you want to come into Penzance, you need to get your shoes on and tell Richard to hurry up. Harriet, if you have a moment, your uncle would like to speak with you.
Hal nodded and looked past Mitzi to where Harding was standing in the drawing room, his back to the door, looking out to the cloud-dark sky and rain-soaked lawns. The sea in the distance was invisible in the mist. Mitzi stood back, ushering Hal inside, then closed the door, and Hal heard her trotting purposefully away up the corridor, lecturing Kitty as she went. Hal stood, waiting nervously for Harding to turn round, but he did not. Instead, he spoke, still facing the view in front of him.
Harriet, thank you for agreeing to meet with me.
For a moment, Hal could not think what to say in reply. The incongruity of the phrase struck her, as though they were both businessmen discussing a merger rather than what? You're welcome, she managed at last, and took a hesitant step forward into the room. But Harding was speaking over her as if he was determined to get through his piece and would not be derailed from his course.
As you may have gathered from Mr. Trezick last night, there is quite a lot of paperwork we need to go through before he can start to move forward on the process of obtaining probate.
Yes, Hal managed. She felt her stomach twist at the mention of paperwork. What could she do? Could she delay the meeting? Or would it be better to go and find out what they needed from her and then claim she had forgotten it? Although I didn't know. I mean, I didn't bring...
There is a great deal we need to discuss, Harding said, waving his hand towards the expanse of green. All this...
He nodded at the lawns falling away in front of the windows.
All this is a great responsibility, and there are a lot of decisions you will need to make, Harriet, and fairly quickly. But that will come later. In the meantime, we have an appointment with Mr. Trezick in Penzance in... He glanced at his watch. Just under 40 minutes, and it will be fairly tight to get there. You don't have a car here?
40 minutes? Hal felt her mouth drop open in horror. This was all moving much too fast. She needed time to research, work out what Mr. Trezick was likely to ask. What if they wanted her to complete forms and she tripped up over some minor detail? Then she realized Harding was waiting for an answer to his question and swallowed. No, she managed faintly.
No matter, we'll squeeze you in. There's a fold-down seat in the boot.
But, she stumbled over the word, unable to make herself articulate it, and began again. Look, there's something I must...
Later, Harriet,
Harding said briskly. His moment of reflection had passed, and he turned, clapping Hal on the shoulder so that she staggered, and then opened the door to the hallway.
There will be plenty of time to talk on the journey, but for now we must get going or we'll be late for Mr. Trezick. The appointment is at 12 noon, so we are already cutting it rather fine.
With a sinking heart, Hal followed Harding into the hall, and from there, out to the front of the house where the car was waiting, the three children belted in the back.
Just a moment, Harriet, while I get the boot seat set up,
Harding said. But his face changed as the big estate boot swung open.
Mitzi, where are the fold-down seats?
What?
Mitzi looked over her shoulder. The engine was already running and her impatience was plain.
What are you talking about, Harding?
The boot seats. Where are they? Harriet is travelling with us.
But she can't. There's no room. We took the seats out to make room for the cases, remember?
Oh, for heaven's sakes! Does no one in this family plan more than 2 steps ahead?
Harding said testily.
Well, there's a simple answer. Freddy will have to stay behind.
Firstly, darling,
Mitzi's voice was brittle as cut glass.
It was your idea to remove the seats, if you remember. And secondly, Freddy can't stay behind. He's a beneficiary. Mr. Trezick needs to see his ID.
Oh, for God's sake,
Harding said explosively. Hal felt a little flicker of hope ignite inside her. Was it possible she would not be able to attend after all? She was just about to offer to remain at the house when a voice came from behind her.
Good morning, all.
Hal and Harding both turned, and Hal heard Harding sigh, a plosive noise like a whale coming up for air.
Ezra,
he said flatly. He was standing, hands in his pockets, grinning widely.
Hello, dear brother, and hello again, Harriet. Nice to see Harding is putting you firmly in the crumple zone. Have you investigated what happens to the estate if Harriet doesn't survive the trip, Harding?
Ezra,
Harding snapped.
That is an
entirely inappropriate joke to make. And no, Harriet won't be travelling in the boot as someone... He ignored Mitzi's eye-rolling sigh of exasperation from the front seat, forgot to pack the spare seats. We were just discussing how to proceed.
Well, I can solve that, Ezra said. I've got to go into Penzance myself. I need to transfer some money while I'm here. I'll give Hal a lift. Oh.
Harding seemed, Hal couldn't quite put her finger on it, almost disappointed at having his bubble of irritation pricked. Or perhaps it was annoyance at having to be beholden to his brother.
Well, that is a neat solution. Excellent.
He shut the boot with a slam and smoothed his barber jacket over his stomach.
Right. Well, do you know where we're heading, Ezra?
Very much so,
Ezra twirled his car keys on his finger.
I may have been out of the country for a while, but Penzance isn't so vast that I'm likely to lose my sense of direction. See you there, Harding.
Very good. Do you have my mobile number?
I don't, Ezra said carelessly.
But given I've survived this long without it, I'm sure we'll manage.
Harding gave an exaggerated sigh and pulled his wallet out of the inner pocket of his barber. Inside was a small stack of business cards. He pulled one off the top and handed it to Hal.
I will entrust you with this, Harriet, as I have very little confidence in Ezra's organizational abilities. Don't lose it, and don't be late.
He opened the passenger door and climbed inside the car.
The appointment is at 12.
But his last words were drowned in the scrunch of tyres on gravel as Mitzi accelerated. Hal heard a faint, "Bye, Hal," from her window, and then the car disappeared out of the gates and down the drive, a cloud of magpies rising indignantly from the trees as they passed below. Chapter 21.
So,
Ezra's voice, as he led the way through the arched gate and around the side of the stable block to a yard, blowing with weeds and grasses, was a long, drawn-out drawl.
You are my niece, I suppose it would be.
Yes, Hal said. The word was almost lost in the scrunch of their feet on gravel, and the sound of the wind in the trees, and when Ezra didn't turn, she said it again, more loudly, trying for more conviction this time. Yes.
Well, well,
Ezra said. He shook his head, but did not elaborate, and instead held out his car key towards the low, dark sports car parked beneath the trees on the other side of the yard. It gave a little beep-beep, and the lights flashed once to show that it was unlocked. As they drew closer, Ezra gave a short, mirthless laugh and looked up at the tree above.
"Little bastards," he said.
"Mother should have had them poisoned."
For a moment, Hal could not work out what he was talking about. She followed his gaze up to the branches above and saw once again the magpies hunched against the sea wind, their bright, beady eyes following her movement. It was only when she looked down at the car that she realized what Ezra meant. From the back, the car looked fine, but as Hal came closer, she could see that the windscreen and the expensive matte paintwork of the bonnet, the parts of the car parked beneath the cover of the trees, were thickly spread with a layer of dense black droppings, halfway between bird guano and something more like a rabbit.
"What is it?"
Hal asked, even as she looked up at the birds overhead and then grimaced. "Sorry, stupid question."
"You guessed right,"
Ezra said a little grimly.
"I should have remembered not to park here. Clearly Harding did. Right, there will now be a short pause while I go for a bucket."
I'm sorry it'll make us late for the appointment, but I can't see to drive, and it etches the paintwork if you leave it on. Stay here and I'll be back as soon as I can.
Don't worry, Hal said. She watched Ezra as he turned and walked back across the yard, leaving her alone with the car and the cawing of the birds. A few minutes later, he returned with a bucket of warm water.
Stand back,
he said briefly, and Hal stepped hastily out of the way, just in time for Ezra to sluice the car, making the birds above screech and cackle as they rose into the air and then resettled.
That's as good as it'll get without a proper car wash, he said at last. I suggest you get in and we'll make good our escape while we can.
As they passed through the wrought iron gates onto the open road, Hal felt as if an enormous weight had lifted from her shoulders. But she didn't realize that she had let out an audible sigh of relief until Ezra turned to look at her, the corner of his mouth twisted into a wry acknowledgement.
Glad I'm not the only one.
Oh, Hal felt herself flush. I didn't mean...
Please... I'm not one for hypocrisy. It's a horrible place. Why do you think we all got out as soon as we could?
I'm sorry, Hal said. She didn't quite know what to say. It's strange because it's such a beautiful building in some ways.
It's just a house, Ezra said briefly. It was never a home, not even when I lived there.
Hal said nothing. Harding's words to Mitzi echoed in the back of her head.
My mother was a bitter, poisonous woman, and her one aim in life was to spread that poison as far and wide as she could.
Ezra had grown up with that poison. They all had. Was Harding right? Was the decision to leave the house to Hal his mother's last act of vengeance?
I have no interest in that place, Ezra said.
He glanced over his shoulder as they came up to a blind bend, hugging the curve of the road.
I only came back to see my mother buried. I'm telling you this, Harriet, so that you understand there's no hard feelings on my part about my mother's will. Understand, my only wish in all this is to leave this place now and for good. You can do what you like with it as far as I'm concerned. Sell it. Tear it down, I really don't care.
I understand, Hal said quietly. There was a silence in the car while she searched for something to say, something to forestall the questions that would come if she let the silence stretch out too long. Control the conversation, she heard her mother's voice in her ear. Make sure you are in the driving seat, not the client. She felt a sudden, overwhelming rush of longing to know about her mother's past, about her connection to this place. What had it been like coming here as an orphan cousin? Had her mother felt the same oppression that Ezra had described, that Hal herself had felt? How long had she stayed? A week, a month, a year? If only she could ask Ezra. He must have known her. The photograph, warm in Hal's back pocket, was evidence of that. Evidence that they had met. Spoken. Your car, Hal said at last, struggling for a remark. It's a left-hand drive, I've just realised. Do you live abroad?
I do,
Ezra said. For a minute, he seemed disinclined to say more, but then he added...
I live in the south of France, near Nice. I own a small photographic gallery down there.
How lovely, Hal said, and the envy in her voice was no fabrication. I went to Nice once on a school trip. It was beautiful.
It's a nice place, yes,
Ezra said shortly. Have you lived there long? Hal asked.
20 years or so, Ezra said.
Hal did the maths in her head as he stepped on the accelerator to pass a parked car. He could not be more than 40, which meant he must have left England almost as soon as he left school. London had not been far enough for him.
"You live in Brighton, don't you?"
he asked, glancing across at her. Hal nodded. "Yes. It's nice, too. The beach isn't as spectacular as Nice, but I don't know. I can't imagine living far from the sea."
"Me neither."
They continued in silence for a while. It was only when they reached the outskirts of Penzance that something occurred to Hal and she broke the quiet in the car. The phrase felt strange and false on her tongue, but she forced it out. "Uncle Ezra, do you speak French?" He glanced across from the road, his expression a little quizzical, with an element of some scepticism Hal couldn't quite pin down.
"I do. Why do you ask?"
"I wondered. I heard a phrase. Après moi le déluge. What does it mean?" "It's something about a flood, isn't it?"
"Literally, yes."
Ezra shot her a look and then indicated a turn in front of a lorry. After they had completed the turn, he spoke again.
"But it's a famous saying in France. It's usually attributed to Louis XV, who was the last king before the revolution came and destroyed his son. The literal meaning is, as you say, after me comes the flood, but the real meaning is something more profound and ambiguous. It means either, after I go, everything will collapse into chaos because I have been the only person holding back the dam, or else something even darker."
"Even darker?" Hal said. She gave a small laugh. "That's pretty dark already."
"It depends how you take it, though. Does it mean, I am dying, I have done all I can to prevent this, but now it must take its course? Or does it mean..."
He paused, waiting for a gap in the traffic, and Hal realized she understood what he was saying. "I suppose there's a sense of not just knowing what may come, but willing it to happen," she said. "Acknowledging your part in precipitating it. Is that what you're saying?"
"Exactly."
Hal could not quite work out what to say in reply to this. The thought came to her again, an old woman, knowing the end was coming near, rubbing her hands as she drew up the will that was to set her nearest and dearest at each other's throats. Had it really been as calculatingly vicious as that? There was no love lost between Harding and Ezra. You didn't have to be a cold reader to work that out. But what was her own part in all this? They drove the last mile or so in silence, Hal lost in her own thoughts, until at last Ezra drew into a car park and stopped the car, pulling up the handbrake with a crunch and killing the engine.
"Well, here we are. There's just one hitch."
"What's that?"
"It's 12:20. I think we've missed the appointment."
"Oh," Hal said. She glanced at the clock on the dashboard and felt a sudden sickening mix of emotions wash over her. A queasy relief at not having to face Mr. Trezick today, and trepidation at the thought of Harding's reaction, and at the knowledge that she had only postponed the encounter. Fuck! It was out before she had considered it, and she bit her lip. The word was not in keeping with the image she was trying to present to the Westaways. Meek, unassuming little Harriet, butter wouldn't melt. Swearing wasn't part of the deal, and she felt as cross with herself as if she'd sworn at a client. The pink on her cheeks was real, though it was a flush of annoyance at her own unguardedness rather than shame. "Sorry, that was..."
"Oh, for God's sake, you're an adult. I'm not your keeper. And while we're at it, can we stop with the Uncle Ezra business? I'm not your uncle."
Hal flinched, in spite of herself. and perhaps Ezra noticed, for he rephrased.
I didn't mean that as coldly as it sounded.
But we've never met.
Uncle implies a relationship that we don't have, and as I said before, Harding has the monopoly on hypocrisy in this family. I'm done with all that.
Okay, Hal said slowly. So, what should I call you?
Ezra will do fine, he said.
He opened his car door.
Wait,
Hal said impetuously. She put out her hand towards the gear stick, not quite touching his.
If we're swapping names...
Yes?
Everyone here calls me Harriet, but that's not what my...
She stopped. She had been about to say that's not what my mother called me, but somehow the words stuck in her throat.
That's not what my friends call me, she finished.
Ezra raised one eyebrow interrogatively.
And that is...
he prompted.
Hal,
Hal said. Her heart was beating as though she had given away a great piece of herself. There was no logic to it. These people knew her real name, who she was, even where she lived, thanks to Mr. Trezick. Compared to what she had done already, there was nothing identifying or risky about sharing a nickname, yet it felt like a leap of faith in a way that nothing else had.
They call me Hal.
Hal,
Ezra said. He said it slowly, as if rolling the word around his mouth, tasting it.
Hal.
Then his tanned face broke into a broad grin, generous, beguiling, quite different from his usual rather sardonic expression.
I like it. Well, shall we go and report him for a telling off?
Yes, Hal said. She drew a deep breath and opened the car door. The tin of tarot cards felt hard in her back pocket, and she thought of the page and of the storm clouds roiling behind him and the rough waves at his feet. The rising waters.
Après moi, le déluge.
Yes. Let's go.
Chapter 22.
Marvellous!
Harding's voice was sarcastic.
You do realise what you've just insured, don't you, Harriet?
Me?
Hal felt a wave of annoyance at the injustice of his remark wash over her and swallowed it back, remembering her role as a meek, biddable niece. She was arranging her face in an expression of contrition when Ezra broke in, sounding bored.
Harding, if anyone is at fault here, it's me. Or rather those fucking magpies.
Magpies be damned, today is Friday. In case you haven't noticed, the solicitor's offices are closed tomorrow and Sunday. Your tardiness has just ensured that we will all have to hang around until Monday to continue the discussions.
Let me guess,
Ezra said, and there was an edge in his voice that Hal remembered from breakfast.
You'll be docking my pocket money and taking away my Xbox privileges.
Monday? Surely not, Mitzi interrupted. Why can't we come back this afternoon?
They were standing outside Mr. Trezick's office, on a narrow little back street with a view looking down towards the choppy harbour waters.
Unfortunately, Mr. Trezick has an unavoidable appointment in Truro this afternoon. That was the whole point of meeting before lunch, so he won't be available until Monday morning at the earliest. And although the identification documents could no doubt be dealt with by post, there are papers to sign and a huge amount to discuss which can really only be accomplished face to face, not least the vexed question of Mrs. Warren.
But the children need to be back at school on Monday, Mitzi protested.
Harding sighed heavily.
Well, I very much regret it, but I think the only sensible solution is for you and the children to return.
and for Ezra, Abel, Harriet and myself to stay until this is sorted out.
Speak for yourself,
Ezra said. He sounded bored again now, his irritation back under control, though Hal had the impression his temper was still there, like a dog barely kept at heel.
I don't intend to hang around, and I don't suppose Abel does either. We're not named in the will, why should we?
Unfortunately, Harding said rather testily,
it appears that you are, as am I, as is Abel. Not as beneficiaries, but a little talk just now with Mr. Treswick's receptionist revealed a delightful little nugget that he omitted to mention. For some reason, Mother saw fit to make the three of us joint executors, along with Mr. Treswick himself.
What?
Ezra's face was incredulous.
You heard me.
You must be joking. It's almost like she wanted us here, tearing at each other's throats.
I have no doubt she did, Harding said.
In fact, I'd go as far to say this whole situation was probably engineered with precisely that outcome in mind.
I won't do it,
Ezra said. His face was set, his dark brows knitted, giving him a saturnine look.
I'll renounce it, or whatever the bloody word is. You can't be forced to act as executor.
In the longer term, I'm sure you're right,
Harding said irritably.
But it would be a courtesy to inform Mr. Treswick of that fact, and I'm sure there will be some formalities associated with giving up the role. I highly doubt you can simply get back into your Saab and speed back to Nice without a word to anyone.
That fucking bitch,
Ezra said viciously, and in the ensuing silence, Hal heard Freddy snigger loud and clear.
And you can shut up as well,
Ezra snarled.
Ezra!
Mitzi gasped. Freddy's jaw had dropped, and his face was blank with shock. Behind him, Hal saw that Kitty was stifling her own laugh with her hand. There was a moment's silence, then Mitzi hoisted her handbag on her shoulder and drew herself up to her not very full height.
Well, that is quite enough. Richard, Catherine, Frederick, come, please.
But, Richard began,
I said we are leaving, Mitzi barked. We'll go and find a place for lunch. Harding, I will text you when we've found a cafe.
Harding gave a harumph that might have been acquiescence or might have been annoyance, and Mitzi stalked away up the narrow street, her children in tow. Hal suppressed the urge to run after them, or even better, to keep on running, past the little group, up the high street, and into Penzance Station to board a train back to her old life, and never return here again. As she watched, the little group turned the corner at the top of the street and disappeared.
Fuck,
Ezra said. He ran a hand over his unshaven face and then through his hair, ruffling it up so that it stood on end, the curls sticking out in all direction.
Fuck!
Harding, I'm sorry. That was out of order. The kid... It was just the wrong...
Harding shrugged.
It's not me you need to apologize to, though I dare say a spot of grovelling to Mitzi wouldn't go amiss. But I imagine Freddy's heard worse at school, so I'm sure he'll survive.
I'm sorry,
Ezra said again. And then...
Shit!
Look,
Harding said, a touch of impatience in his voice.
I'm not concerned about Freddy right now. You lost your temper. It's not the end of the world. I'm more concerned about what we do about this damned business with Mr. Treswick. I want this over as much as you do, Ezra. But running away is only going to create more problems. If you insist on leaving, obviously I can't prevent you, but I would suggest that it will probably be a lot quicker, in the long run, to sort this out here and now. rather than shuttling papers and identification documents back and forth across the channel. Harriet,
he turned to her.
I'm very sorry for this inconvenience, but I take it you will be able to negotiate a day off work, given the circumstances.
I'm not sure, Hal said, feeling both their eyes on her. The image flashed into her head again of herself as a rat, backed into a corner, scrabbling for a way out.
If you're... employer would like to speak to someone about this.
No, it's fine, Hal said hastily. I'm self-employed, anyway. I only have myself to think about. She should probably phone Mr. White, ask someone to put a note up on the kiosk to explain the situation to any clients who dropped past. But he could hardly kick up a fuss for a family bereavement. And midweek in early December, no one would miss her. Except possibly Reg.
Self-employed?
Harding raised his eyebrows as he buttoned his coat.
I realise I've never asked. Harriet, what do you do?
I work on a pier, Hal said awkwardly. She disliked this question. Her profession came up sometimes with new acquaintances, and invariably it made her the centre of attention in a way that she did not enjoy. The responses varied depending on the social situation. In passing conversation, it could be anything from polite interest to veiled amusement. At parties and in pubs, it was more often guffawing scepticism or clamorous requests for a reading. She had quickly learned not to say psychic because of the aggressive demands to produce an instant prediction there and then.
Tell me what I'm thinking,
Hal remembered one man in a pub saying, almost shoving his face into hers.
Go on, tell me what I'm thinking if you're a bloody mystic, Mog.
He'd looked down at her small breasts and Hal had thought, I know what you're thinking, but she didn't say it. Now, if pressed for details, she simply said she did tarot readings, and when people asked for one, she was able to laugh and say that she didn't have her cards. For a moment, she thought that Harding might be about to ask questions, but fortunately, at that second, his phone buzzed, and when he pulled it out of his pocket, his face brightened.
Ah, it's Mitt. She's found a cafe. Well, Harriet, shall we?
In the car back to Trepasson, Hal was silent. Ezra had not joined them for lunch, pleading the meeting with his bank, and she had waited for a good hour at the prearranged spot in the car park, long after Mitzi and Harding had driven away. When Ezra had finally turned up, there was a smell of whiskey on his breath. His driving seemed unaffected, however, though Hal had not been able to stop herself from wincing when he pulled out in front of a fast-moving Land Rover. They were almost back to Trepasson House when Ezra spoke.
Are you okay? You're very quiet.
Sorry, Hal said. She forced herself to sit up straighter, paint a slightly nervous smile on her lips. Remember, you're a mouse. Not a rat. Little, mousy Harriet. I was just thinking.
About?
It's... She paused, trying to think of something that would be the truth, but not the truth. But the words came out almost in spite of herself. It's just... Harding... And his family, I don't think they realise how lucky they are, in some ways. Ezra said nothing, but he cocked another glance at her and then shifted down a gear for a tight bend.
They are lucky, he said at last. And you're right, they don't know it. Maybe that's what made me lash out at poor Freddy.
He rubbed his hand over his face and sighed, and Hal smelled again the faint scent of whiskey.
Whatever Harding's faults, and God knows he's got them, he's a better parent than most.
My mother was a wonderful parent, Hal said. Her voice shook in spite of herself, and she clenched her jaw, thinking, I will not cry. Not now, not here. I will not use her death to get his sympathy. But she could not stop a single tear tracing its way down her nose. She scrubbed it away fiercely. At least, whatever I've lost, I had her for 18 years. I wouldn't have changed a thing in all that time. Ezra changed gear again, and then said, with a perceptible effort,
Harriet, Abel told me about...
He swallowed hard.
About what happened to Maud, the car accident. He said that...
He stopped, and Hal saw that his face was twisted with grief.
I never knew.
His voice was hoarse, and Hal had the sense that here at last was someone whose grief was as real and encompassing and raw as her own.
I searched for her for years, and I never knew that all that time she was alive and well and living just across the channel, and it... God, it kills me. I am so, so angry with her. How could she?
I don't know, Hal whispered, and she felt again the tearing sense of betrayal at the lie she was perpetuating here. She had not understood when she set foot on that train what she was setting in motion. The lies about herself, about her own background, the game with Mr. Trezick, all that felt like a game. But this playing with people's past tragedies, none of this was what she had signed up for. What must it be like to lose your twin? Your other half. I'm sorry, she said, her voice husky with the strain of holding back tears. I shouldn't have brought her up. I didn't mean. She stopped, and Ezra shook his head, but not admonishingly. Instead, the gesture seemed to express something they could neither of them say.
What about your father?
He asked at last, and then cleared his throat. They had come out of the sunken lane and were on to the cliff road that wound inland to Trepassen. Hal found herself staring out of the window at the dark expanse of sea, flint-coloured and strange, so different from Brighton's chalk-milky waters. I never knew him, she said. Her voice was steady now. This part wasn't painful, at least. There were no betrayals in telling this story. And it was a question she'd answered many times before. He was a one-night stand. My mother never knew his name.
So he could be out there, somewhere?
Ezra asked. Hal shrugged. I suppose so. But I can't see any prospect of finding him, even if I wanted to.
You don't want to, then?
Not really. You don't miss what you never had. It was true, in a way. But even as she said it, Hal thought of Harding at lunch, his arm around Kitty holding her tightly against the breeze from the door. And she knew it was only half true. 8th of December, 1994. Abel came home from Oxford today. Term ended last weekend, but he came home the long way via a friend's house in Wales, trailing his feet. I don't blame him for his reluctance. Harding, who I still haven't met, sent a brisk message saying the accountancy firm he works for in London couldn't spare him and that he would not be returning for Christmas. And Ezra's school doesn't break up for another week. The first I knew of his arrival was Maud pricking up her head like a collie that has caught a noise. We were sitting in the drawing room, the only warm room in the whole house, apart from my aunt's sitting room. We were huddled close to the fire, me playing patience, Maud reading and listening to something on her Walkman. I was frowning over a particularly knotty spread when suddenly she pulled off her headphones.
"Jesus," she said. "We must look like something out of Little Fucking Women. What..."
She broke off abruptly and listened for a moment. Then, before I could ask what she had heard, she was running out of the drawing room, down the corridor, towards the front door.
"Ow!"
I heard, and his answering shout, and I followed, in time to see her rush into his arms. He picked her up, spinning her round in a giant bear hug, while she screeched out laughing protests. "Hi, Abel," I said, suddenly shy, and he nodded at me over the top of Maud's head as he deposited her down on the hallway rug. "Hi, Maggie." And that was it. The kind of greeting you'd give a stranger or a passing acquaintance. He picked up his case, slung one arm around Maud's shoulders, and went back to talking to her about his term, about some girl he was seeing, and I felt